burnout. This is something everybody faces, guys. And I'm not talking about that low-level burnout. I'm talking about the kind that leaves you with so much built-up tension and burden from life that you start having these awful, dark thoughts that cycle around your head like, I hate my life. I'm done. I'm exhausted. I want to throw in the towel. The more you let the stuff build up inside from the tensions of everyday life without dealing with them, the more you literally might be leading yourself to death. I'm going to talk today about the way out of all that with a dear friend of mine who knows the stress of letting all the burdens of the world build up inside of him. As he dealt as a police officer and first responder and a person who'd be the first in to combat someone who might want to kill him, to protect and serve, as the person who was the first guy to arrive at the scene of a tragedy and watched all that build up inside of him for years and years without talking to anybody till the dam almost broke and he started having thoughts about taking his life. Well, he's got an incredible story about coming out of that on the other side. Welcome to the Chris Stefanik Show. We are here every week to give you the tools and inspiration you need to live your everyday life with joy, even when life gets crazy. I want to thank our missionaries of joy. You are changing lives with every episode. If you're watching us, I know it's because you want inspiration. Now, if you want daily inspiration, click below this video and sign up for the Daily Anchor. We put it in your inbox every day, no strings attached. We just want to bless you. This episode is sponsored in part by EWTN. You can catch this and so much more on EWTN Plus streaming. Link below in the show notes. I love you so much, man. I'm just so stoked that you're here. Thanks for coming.
Oh, I'm so happy to be here.
Yeah. Okay, when you think about your career as a cop, how long have you been a cop for?
Well, I think this year is, if you go back to reserve time, is year 34.
You started when you were what, 12?
I was 18.
I'm
now 52.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, so when you think about on a career, what's one experience of getting a bad guy that when you think of it, you think, oh yeah, you know, testosterone and adrenaline just kick right up the second you think of it.
I think sometimes, you know, in a law enforcement life, you get a lot of apprehensions. You put a lot of bad guys in jail. You find justice for a lot of people, but the job's 24/7. It doesn't ever stop. And some of my favorite memories are opportunities that happened off shift, where you were just there and something happened in your presence and you had to act.
Wow.
Then your family watches, right? And sometimes it's scary, sometimes it's worrisome. My mother one evening was watching the 5 o'clock news and saw a flash of me and said to my dad, God rest his soul, Byron, come here, you gotta see the TV. I just saw Jeff. And he must be on the next story.
Yeah.
And so my parents hustle in and my dad's there watching the TV. And it's a news story about the sheriff's office getting tasers. And in the next 30 seconds, my parents watch me get lit up and scream at the top of my lungs.
They lit you up with a taser?
Yeah, as a test? Yeah, because when you get certified to use the taser, you have to be tasered.
They still do that today?
Yeah.
I was going to say, maybe this is one of those like 1980s things before.
Yeah, the joke in law enforcement is I carry a gun, but I was never shot. But yeah, no, you get tasered to get certified. So here's my parents, you know, later in life. And, you know, my mom yells, Byron, come here. And they're watching the TV and, you know, they're so proud of me. And next thing you know, they see me standing like this and they've got the electrical prongs in the back and the guy's saying, okay, in 3, 2, 1. And no one had told me when you get tasered, you expel all the air from your lungs so you don't scream. No one had told me that.
That's awful.
So I took a nice deep breath, I said a Hail Mary to myself. And next thing you know, I just screamed at the top of my lungs. And when the electricity hits you, it locks up all your muscles. So I sat there shaking and screaming at the top of my breath for 3 seconds. It stops and they drop you on a mat and you sit there and quiver for a second, catch your breath. My poor parents, my mother's holding their chest and well, this was like 2 o'clock in the afternoon that this happened, and it runs at the 5 o'clock early news. And my mother's like, oh my word, what are we gonna do? What are we gonna do? He can't be okay. So she goes over and grabs the phone and she pages me. I used to have a pager, right? Well, it's hours later. I'm on patrol. I've brought a person in.
And you don't respond?
Well, I brought a person in the ER. I brought him in for a psych eval, the psych hold, and I'm standing in the ER. And my pager goes off and I look and it's my parents' number, *911, which was a code we had if something breaks and you need me, Just put 911 in the call and I'll call you immediately. So my mom's on the other end of the phone. I call. I'm like, hey, mom, what's going on? Where are you? Are you okay? I said, oh, I'm in the ER. I knew it. They injured you. And I said, no. No, that was hours ago. I'm in here with a patient. So, oh, but when you talk
that's
about.
That's not the kind of story I expected to hear.
No, like, that's fodder.
That was the rush.
So my dad growing up, he didn't see a lot of police work. He rode with me in my cruiser a couple of times. He wasn't the police type necessarily. Yeah. But he loved a good race. We'd go to the racetrack on Saturday nights. And he and I had a place where my brothers and I would sit with him, the same location in the bleachers over the years. And we got there early, and we found our seat. And we were there a short period of time, and then all of a sudden these guys with these leather vests came in, and they're clearly part of a local Northeast motorcycle gang.
Did you know that for just $15 a month, you can change lives? Seriously, $15 a month. That's the cost of a couple lattes. But instead of coffee, you're fueling something eternal. Because of our Missionaries of Joy, our monthly supporters, people are coming back to the church. Families are being strengthened. The gospel is reaching millions. Everything we do, the Chris Stefanik Show, life-changing video series like Living Joy, Rise, Fearless, and Renewed, our live events, it all exists because of people like you. For just $15 a month, you can become part of this mission. And as you participate in this work, we're going to equip you, inspire you, and empower you to live the gospel in your daily life and to help others do the same. When you become a monthly donor, a Missionary of Joy, you're not just donating. You're actually making this mission possible. You're helping us bring hope, truth, and joy to a world that desperately needs it. And that's not all. As a Missionary of Joy, you get exclusive access to all our video series and empowerment to share them in small groups with friends. You get exclusive early access to new releases. You get Monday motivation texts direct from me. And you get access to our daily anchor, daily inspiration to fuel your faith. For less than 50 cents a day, you could bring the joy of the gospel to the world that desperately needs it. Please sign up in the link below this show description. We literally can't do this work without you.
They're clearly part of a local Northeast motorcycle gang. We don't have many, and they're not really violent, but they're an odd lot. And they come in and they sit right around us and envelop us.
Huh.
And, you know, we got into the races, and there's a series of heats. They go to feature races. They go to the big race at the end of the night. And during qualifiers, one car knocked another car off the track. And down in front, there's a local mainer with his significant other. And they get quite upset that their favorite racer got knocked off the track. And they start screaming and yelling at the car every time it comes by. Well, I watch, and they're making a scene. And there's a deputy, a young deputy, walking up through. And he's got his big, round, brown Stetson. Probably my age, right? When I started, 18, 19.
18, 19 years
old.
On
a summer beat, just covering security at a local racetrack. And he comes up, and he tells this guy, you need to calm down. And he's pointing his flashlight at him. And the guy quieted down for a minute, but he started doing it again. So he went back, and again, he pointed his flashlight at him. And the next thing you know, he takes that flashlight and rips it away. And the deputy jumps on him, and the two of them go down into the bleachers. And there's fists flying, and this deputy's getting the worst of it.
My gosh.
And here I'm sitting with my dad. He's like, what are you going to do? I'm like, what are you going to do? And the motorcycle gang's getting all flustered. They're like chanting and whatnot. And I push right down through them because I got to go to work. And I jump on top the two of them, and I'm trying to peel this guy off the deputy who's on the bottom getting choked out, and his Stetson's off and in the dirt.
Wow.
Flag man comes down to the flag stand, jumps on me, and he starts punching me as I'm yanking on the guy, and the deputy's on the bottom. And so before long, I grab the deputy's collar mic, and I just yell 1074, we need units, and which is a call for help in Maine.
Yeah.
And next thing you know, here comes the cavalry, right? Well, in the end, the flag man turns around, and I look at him, I said, I'm a cop, stop punching me. He turns around and runs up in the stands. Cops show up, they arrest the guy. Guy gets his Stetson back on, gets his flashlight back, tucks his shirt back in, and goes back on his beat. And I go up through this pack of motorcycle guys, and they give me a standing ovation. And my dad's at the top, smiling ear to ear, clapping as well. And I sat down, and one of them turned to me and said, that was a good fight. It would have been better if there was blood. Yeah, the good old days. So it's sometimes it's that opportunity to show your family the reality of the work you do.
Yeah.
You know? So that's fun.
Wow. Why did you want to be a cop? And then, by the way, no matter how old you get, it's always great when dad sees a glory moment.
Oh, my word. It is.
My dad saw that.
It is, and it's just as good as you get older for your teenage sons who are right full of vigor to see that the old man still can fight his way out, you know, and work for justice.
That's it, man.
You know, my choice to get in this job was, it was later in life. A lot of guys, a lot of my peers I went to the academy with would say things like, oh, I always wanted to be a cop. You know, I watched Chips when I was a kid, and I knew I just wanted to be Ponch, you know, or whatever. And for me, that wasn't me. Mm. I'd gotten through high school. I'd been accepted in the University of Maine to follow up in mechanical engineering education. I was thinking ahead in that way. I thought that was the thing my dad wanted me to do. Mm. And I happened to go on a ride-along. We had a three-day block my senior year where we could do whatever we wanted to just kind of search out a vocation if there was something we wanted to do that was unique. And one of my buddies had lined up this three-day ride-along with the state police, with the county, and another day of being a police cadet at the academy. Well, Cops was big at the time, the show.
Oh, yeah.
I thought, this could be a lot of fun. I could just sit in the front seat and watch what happens.
Yeah.
Well, thank God I rode with a state trooper who was awesome. Later in life, he became a very good friend. I've worked cases with him, you know, and he took me on a ride-along where we stopped cars, we answered calls, we had some really deep conversations. He bought me lunch, which I never forgot, at this diner out in the country. And, you know, the following day, I rode with a local PD, saw what that life was like again, calls for service, helping people in need. Mm-hmm. And then that last day, I got to be a cadet. I got up at 5 o'clock in the morning, put on my sweats, run the mile and a half, do the push-ups, get yelled at, marched into chow, got inspected by the cadre. Mm. I thought, I think I like this. Mm. The more I thought about it, I recognized that it sort of matched up with my desire to do something greater with my life. The call to service is a very unique one. It's sort of indelible on your heart. It's like one of these things that you can't explain, but you know it's in you. Like, you've got one life and you want to have an impact on others.
There's the sheep and the sheepdog.
I'm telling you, that's the most beautiful and on point analogy that anyone ever came up with when it comes to police work. There's a recognition of the very sort of naive and frail nature of human day-to-day life, where the comfort in life is not knowing the dark side of what could happen. Hmm. And to be able to be the one who drives that marked car at 3 a.m. through a neighborhood so people can sleep in peace. To be the one that, you know, is able to be called to a situation out of control and to bring control and to tell somebody, to reassure someone and say, it's gonna be okay. Mm. We've got answers. There's something we can do about this and we're gonna bring normalcy back in your life. Mm. It's a great gift.
That's beautiful. It's the thin blue line that separates us from chaos.
It is, and it's interesting. I can remember some of those earliest days with my field training officer. I feel like I came into law enforcement at the best time. I started in 91. I went full-time in 95. But I was broken in by cops from the 70s and 80s. Hmm. And a lot of those guys had seen a different time. They'd seen harder work. They'd seen a lack of respect. But they'd also done it with less technology and less support. And so some of those guys were really good to learn from. But in my era and in my tenure, I've watched technology take over. And we've become better and more efficient. We've become better trained. We've watched better services, you know, be available to our taxpayers and to the police officer. Mm. It's been a great time to be in this job.
And you switch your training from, you know, when push comes to shove, being able to punch someone in the face like that guy in the experience you had to grappling and like the things that are more next level. But you've had this perception of being a cop, and you still do. It's beautiful that you're called to protect and serve. But that never turns off. That's got to get exhausting because, like you say, you're always on duty. When you were in the stands with your dad, you were on duty.
Yeah,
you're at the airport today. You're probably looking around, surveying who's around you. Most of us aren't aware of the reality that there are people who are. I hate saying bad people, because everyone's redeemable, but there are people who are nefarious
and
who will hurt you if there's not guys who will stand in the way.
Yeah.
That's it. You see that all the time.
I do, and it does change, man.
Yeah.
Yeah, or a woman. It changes you doing this job. You have seen the dark underbelly. You know the potential of situations, and it makes you hypervigilant. You may not want to be. Much of it's subconscious, but you're right. I'm flying through terminals yesterday, packed full of people. I don't go to mass without sizing up everybody there. The pew structure, I establish the exits, start thinking about, well, if we had a shooter here or we had a, you know, a mass casualty situation or maybe even a medical situation, how would we get out of here? How would I get my family to safety? How would I deal with it? How would I get the priest off the altar? How would I become the one? How would I draw the attention of the aggressor so he can escape? You don't stop doing that. You go to the grocery store and you're sizing up the people that are passing. The door opens and closes in a gathering or a meeting and you give them a look because you may have to go to work. And it's an honor. Let me be very clear. To be that person is an honor. But it is a heavy cross to carry day after day because you watch things like your kids going off to school. And you watch your children go off to college and you have to drive away. Your kids get a driver's license and you've been to endless fatal accidents and mass casualty situations in vehicles. And you pray because you know what can happen. So it's not easy. But again, to be able to be that person is so unique. And it's such an honor to be able to give back to society in that way.
I want to dive more into the experience of brokenness and how sometimes people just burn out from that, not just because it'll help people in law enforcement, but people who are just, frankly, parents who are burning out and facing depression, not knowing how to talk about it. But first, there's a great beauty to what you're describing and that vocation to serve, right? We've all seen news stories where a guy's clearly burnt out, is a triggered human being, he's raw, he's angry, and he's smeared the entire reputation of what it means to be a cop, right?
Yeah.
But you experience this probably throughout your entire career, that you have this ideal and this idealism about what you're called to do. And then, you know, you're in a grocery store and a little kid touches something and a mom sees you and says, oh, don't do that or he's gonna get you.
Oh, my word.
Right? Like were you surprised by the stigma that you had as a cop, like from day one?
Yeah, it's very interesting. And it's changed a bit.
Yeah,
and it's a consumer by consumer sort of thing, but it's very common. That if I had a dollar for every time I had heard a mom say that,
yeah, you're like, thanks a lot.
Yeah, I'll just let him take care of this. When I first started on the job, there was this old terminology called whoever's finest. We're in Denver, so a cruiser would go by and be like, oh, there goes Denver's finest. Mm-hmm. So in a community, you were recognized as the best that town had to give. There was an honor to do that job, right? And so I brought this up before, but I came on the job like July 1st, right after I graduated high school. And on the 4th of July, I got to march in the parade with a flag, And I remember walking down the road, marching with three other guys, presenting the colors, and looking over, and there's my lunch lady from high school. And she's got tears running down her face because she's so proud of me for doing the job I'm doing. That was one of those sort of core memories, right? Never forgetting it. Like, this is something of honor. Be able to wear this uniform and the badge that has my town's name in it or my county or my state is very unique. But this job always worked for me because I had an empathetic heart. I was one of those kids that always felt compassionate. I remember going to the Fox and the Hound as a kid and having to leave early because I was breaking down in tears because I felt so bad, It's one of those things, though, that it enabled me to be able to give back to my community and recognize the plight of victims. And I love the opportunity to work for justice. Especially in those circumstances where that person doesn't have a voice. But in those situations, sometimes I think just wearing the uniform, we have this thing we call officer presence. In fact, sometimes
officer presence
is often referred to as like the first piece on like the use of force continuum we talk about. And the first thing is just showing up in uniform. You know, being 6'4 and wearing the big Smokey the Bear that makes you 6.5 feet tall, and you show up, and all of a sudden, a lot of the tomfoolery is gone. But to be able to be that person, that a mom stops and recognizes your authority and tries to, in some sort of way, use it to her advantage with her child, it's disheartening. Usually I would take my hat off, get down on one knee, and say, has this woman done anything that's upset you? I can deal with her as well if you like. You know? But later in life, I found these situations where being a dad, I'm a dad of 7 kids. I had children earlier than a lot of my peers. I was on an entry team in full kit, going through, kicking a door on a drug warrant, you know, clearing the house room by room, taking suspects down, cuffing them up. And then I'd hear, Wrigley, we got a kid in the back bedroom. Because I was a dad, I had these qualifications no one else had. And the next thing you know, I've got a toddler. Mm. You know, I got a ballistic vest. Quite often I had my rosary coming out of one of my utility pockets, and I got some little shaver playing with my rosary, and we're talking, and I'm trying to find them, you know, a drink, a sippy cup, and some graham crackers, while my other guys are looking for crack cocaine.
Wow.
And it was, again, it was that empathy in that moment. That child didn't choose to be there. He didn't choose that drug-dealing parents. And this isn't the end of this child's road. The child was, you know, created in love.
So you grew up a faithful Christian and converted to Catholicism.
I did.
Yeah, buddy. Was your faith informing you in those moments? Were you bringing scriptures to mind when you're dealing with bad guys, when you're picking up a kid and you're feeling the empathy? Was there a conscious awareness that I'm Jesus in this moment in a particular way?
Yeah. You know, being raised in a faithful home where we were, you know, we memorized scripture. I went to a private Christian school, and like a good Protestant, I knew a lot of the most popular scriptures. Now, there was one that stood out to me, and my mother, I remember her talking to me about it, Matthew 24. The disciples are entering a really high-stress situation. Jesus is telling them the end of time is coming. I'm no longer going to be with you. And they're immediately stressed. They're asking him questions about what they're to do, how am I to act, what am I supposed to do to be prepared? And his answer is, well, first of all, don't be stressed. Don't worry. Don't be a fear. And he says this one really unique thing. And in my life, it became my credo. It became this sort of haunting little phrase that would come back to me in high stress moments. And I say haunting because it told me to do something I didn't always want to do. And it was Christ's own words to his disciples. He said, what you have done for the least of these, you've done unto me. And you got to know that when you have a man on the ground that you've wanted to arrest, and you have him in a compromised position where you could probably drop your knee into his ribs, or when you pick up a baby has a soiled diaper and a drug warrant, and you could just put him back in the, you know, back in the bed, or you're at the roadside and you could write a stack of tickets to someone who has just lost their job and they have tears rolling down their face. Mm. You can justify a lot of things. But in the back of your head, when you hear words, the words of Christ say, what you have done to the least of these, you've done unto me.
That's powerful.
It's heavy.
I mean, the one solution to every problem in civilization is Jesus.
Can you imagine?
Right?
Love.
Like, there's no amount of training of, like, here's how you're supposed to act that'll make you a compassionate cop who doesn't drop his knee on someone's neck or in someone's ribs. Like, the amount of training, it goes out the window if there's not the Lord forming you and speaking to you in the back of your head in those moments.
Yeah.
It just solves it all.
And I gotta tell you, I understand the frustration.
Yeah.
I understand the idea of, in the moment, thinking you are the one that brings justice. It's very easy when you are actually the link between the event and justice playing out.
You're in the chaos.
You're the one that brings peace, and then you bring the person to justice. It'd be very easy to act out of passion. You've seen the destruction. You've been with the victims, and now you have this person in hand. And you're also dealing with the impact of the culture you're in. You've seen all the worst things that society has to give. When their life gets out of hand, there's a three-digit number you call, right?
Yeah, yeah.
911. I can no longer control my existence, and I need things to calm down and get back under control quickly. You don't know what you're going to. Quite often, you go lights and sirens, you're trying to assess what you have by what a dispatcher is telling you through a groveled speaker, and you don't always know what you're showing up to. You may walk away feeling like a hero. You may walk away scarred for life based upon what you had to deal with. And sometimes, to get back to that situation, when you're with the aggressor, it would be very easy to make a bad decision. But that's why we need to be anchored in something like faith and understand that we are just a gear in a great machine that's processing this thing we call justice.
You know, back to entering into that chaos, when you get that call and there's domestic violence, where there's someone who's really out of control, who's scary, who's dangerous, who might kill you on the other side of that door.
Yeah.
And, you know, for all the garbage cops get, even the ones who are broken, they're still the ones who will run to you when no one else does.
Yeah.
They're gonna show up first. They're gonna race to you where other people are trying to get away from the psychopath inside the house.
Yeah.
And not only are you the very first one in, you know, when you're an 18, 19, 20-year-old in Maine, in rural Maine as a cop, you're also the only one.
Sure.
It's not like you have a big force behind you in a town like that.
Sure.
How are you steeling yourself? How are you readying yourself for that moment? What's going through your heart and mind? Like the first times you were opening that door.
Yeah.
What's that feeling like? Is it terror? Is it apprehension? Is it like testosterone kicks in and I'm gonna bring command into this place?
What is it? It's an interesting circumstance, and it's something that I don't think you ever... Bravery doesn't mean an absence of fear,
mm-hmm.
right? I think bravery without fear is dangerous.
Mm.
I think the fact of the matter is it's something that you start to work on more and more, and you recognize that emotion doesn't help you in circumstances like that. You fall back on things like training, but at the core, it really comes back to your own character. There really is such a thing as shaking in your boots. Mm. I have felt my heels hopping up and down on the bottom of my shoes. Because I recognize the gravity of the circumstance I'm in. There's something to be said about, you know, having the radio silence break in the middle of the night and having the dispatcher say, can you please respond to such and such address? You have a subject there who is, you know, a self-inflicted gunshot wound to the head. Or you have a fight in progress with multiple subjects involving weapons. And you recognize my backup's 25 miles away. On and on and on,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And so the worst of what society can give you.
Yeah.
It's not easy, but at the same time, they've got you. Someone out there has no one other than you to respond. So that's where the selflessness has to take over. Hmm. And it's hard. Sometimes I've been asking myself, I have been driving to a scene and thought to myself, wouldn't it have been easier to be a plumber?
Yeah.
Why am I not in bed right now sleeping, you know, while the rest of the world churns? But no, this is the choice I made. And you push through it. You try to make the best decisions. You try to assess. You immediately assess your threats. And sometimes you go to the fire. You know, a beautiful illustration I've heard 100 times is, you know, blessed are those that run toward the fire when everybody else runs away. And that's all of public safety. Mm. I have so much respect even for my firemen friends, my paramedic pals, you know.
Yeah.
For those people that have assessed that I could get hurt here, but still say, I'm doing it because somebody else needs me. I've sworn an oath. It's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, it's amazing. When it's a violent guy, what percentage of them back down? You know, they might start fighting. There's the initial adrenaline. They swing. Then they realize, I just swung at a cop. Versus the percentage of them where you're alone with this guy fighting and you realize, oh, if I lose, I might end up dead.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think the percentage is fairly high. You know, we're dealing with certain things that are out of control. One of them is mental illness.
Mm.
We're dealing with it a lot. Secondly is alcohol. Sometimes it's a cocktail of alcohol and mental illness.
Mm.
So very often, scruples don't even play in.
Mm.
We walk through the door and the fight is on. And so immediately, again, it's sort of casualty mitigation. Get the victims out, get the suspect alone. Maybe it's, okay, we got the suspect out, now we step back and we establish a perimeter until we get other guys. I remember one night having my canine with me. I was lucky enough to work canine for nearly a decade.
Awesome.
Which is this magical tool that most guys don't have. Yeah. And that was you talk about fight mitigation, is pulling in and hearing a 100-pound German Shepherd barking in the background. Everybody kind of cools down quick when they hear that dog, thanks to those white pearly teeth. But I can remember being on a perimeter with my dog under a poncho liner and a sleeping bag waiting for backup because we had a person who was actively shooting out of the house through the woods and listening to the bullets whistle by.
Man.
It's, again, rural policing isn't like a lot of other places in the fact that you don't have backup, but you do often have time and resources that are not like others.
Hmm.
I can remember one time laying in a ditch with a guy who needed to be removed from his family's home. And sadly, he was schizophrenic and in fight mode. And I asked him out. I knew him. I'd known him a long time. His name is Jeremy. And I said, Jeremy, why don't you come on out? Let's just talk. Let's talk. And he had a downhill lawn. I was going to bring him out to the side of the road in case anybody was coming. It was a very rural spot. And he jumped me. We ended up in the ditch, and I was below him and rolled over, and he instantly started to choke me and was trying to get my gun.
Oh.
And he had a forearm across my throat. I was compromised instantly, and I'm fighting for whatever I could grab.
Wow.
I had him by his hair, his face, trying to push him away, trying to secure and hold my gun. And the next thing you know, I hear the very distinct sound of air brakes. And I look, and this guy pulled over the dump truck, and he came over, and he took him off me, rolled him over, and I was able to get up, and the two of us handcuffed him. The guy said, "You all set?" Yep. He got in his truck and drove away.
Thank you, Lord. That could have been the end right there.
It could have been. I think he may have been an angel driving to Kentworth. I have no idea. Never met him again. Never saw him again.
God bless the main trucker.
Yeah, right. So you have these resources, and a lot of times you have to be able to negotiate with anybody to buy time.
Mm.
If you can.
Can I ask you, as a dad who's always, my brain's always going too. You know, I'm not a cop, but I'm sitting in a restaurant and I'm aware of the utensils that I might use as weapons.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yes.
And I'm looking at things and I got an awareness of the room. A lot of guys share that cross, especially the ADD brain is always down a track somewhere.
Yeah.
What comes in the most handy? Like, was there a particular move or technique that you're practicing again and again as a cop? Where you're like, this is the thing that's going to get me out of a tough situation. An overly simplistic question, but
it is, and I think it starts with your mindset.
Yeah.
Right. Recognizing that there are threats in society. Mm-hmm. That is a good and responsible dad.
Yeah.
Right. I often worry about people that their minds aren't like that because they are the line of victims waiting to happen.
Mm. It's a lot. It's probably most people.
Again, it's the sheepdog and the sheep.
Yeah.
And it's a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
It's much of our American life that we live a very safe existence. The threat isn't...
We think we do.
Right. And the threat... But some people are born in war-torn countries where threat is always at their door.
Mm.
And we have become very fat and lazy and happy.
Mm.
And we really don't really think threat's coming for us. Yeah. And it's because we have a very civilized environment in a very civilized nation we live in. Even though crime exists, we have a system in place that works very well to abate it and control it.
Yeah.
Now, back to that, I think, personally, I think number one comes mindset, and secondly, assessment of your surroundings, recognizing your escape routes, and prioritizing getting your family out. Because you know what your family is going to do. Some of that starts with conversations about, well, if this ever happened, you listen to me, and you make it for the exit, and you run.
Hmm.
And then secondly is assessing the threat. Is the threat to other people? What is your own decision? Are you just looking to get yourself and your family out? Understandable. You get out. If you don't have to go to the threat, get out.
Yeah.
If you feel called to protect others, then you need to go to the threat. And it's probably going to be hands-on, and you need to contain them. And again, the assessment goes on. Do they have a weapon? Is this somebody you can take?
So it's thinking. It's a lot of thinking.
It's all cerebral.
Yeah.
But the problem is most people have never even gone there.
Yeah.
Some of the best trainers I had, we'd ride along on quiet nights, and they'd say, you know, when you're out here in a cruiser, you should be thinking about situations. You'd be thinking about hard situations. Think about calls you had and if something had gone another way.
Hmm.
Like, what would you have done if that guy picked up a knife? What would you have done if his two buddies walked in and now the fight is on? What would you have done? All these hypotheticals, right? And part of that is mental preparedness that most people don't even go into that space.
Yeah.
And that's it's a beautiful thing. Again, I think it's better, though, that you be prepared.
Yeah. And there's a real cost to all this, and we're gonna start digging into the cost. When you decide to put yourself in harm's way between the people who might hurt you and the rest of us, and when you're constantly aware of a threat, it starts to build up an internal tension that can make anybody snap.
Yeah.
But probably even more than dealing with the bad guy or the threat is dealing with tragedies, I would imagine.
Yeah.
And you've seen more of them than most people ever have to see.
Sure.
You're the first one on the scene when there's someone dangerous inside of a house. You're also the first person getting a call when you're 18, 19 years old, there was a fatal car accident. Be the first guy there. Or maybe someone's about to die.
Sure.
Do you feel comfortable sharing
Sure.
some of those moments? And as a man of faith, you know, you're not going in there as a priest or a minister, but you are ministering in a real way in those moments.
Yeah.
Share how you've seen or brought God to some people's last moments.
Again, it's a cross we bear, you know, in this
yeah.
work. But it's a beautiful one. It's an opportunity. The sheriff I worked for a number of years put me in charge of doing death notifications.
Oh.
And he used to say, let's have Wrigley do it. You know, he's willing to hug anyone. And so thanks, Sheriff. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
The fact of the matter, I used to talk to a lot of guys about death notification, and that is painful and hard. But having the death occur, it is an honor to be that one selected to bring that message to the family.
Mm.
And it's heavy. But at the same time, you know you're stepping into a core memory for that family that they will never forget.
Mm.
And to be able to handle that with kindness and with reverence and with patience, and to show them love at a time, or to show them, I should say, compassion at a time when they're so broken. There was a time, I think there's been many circumstances, Chris. One that comes to mind off top of my head, I was on a patrol one Friday evening. It was a summer night, it was beautiful. It was mid-July in Maine, it was like 72 degrees, windows
perfect.
Were open.
There's two perfect weeks in Maine.
I was gonna say, it's like one of the 2 weeks of summer. And
yeah.
In the beat I was on, we had a section of I-95 that cuts right through the town.
Mm.
And true to life, it's a Friday night. There's a family preparing for a Saturday wedding. And they're at the local Catholic church. And they're going through the pieces and parts, practicing for tomorrow. Mm. And everyone's there. The groomsmen and the bride and the bride's family and the groom and his family. And it hits him as he arrives, this groom, a young man in his 20s, I forgot the rings. I want to have the rings here. So he's driving his dad's Mustang that's all shined up for the next day. Probably the only time he gets to drive it, the top's down. And the easiest way to get back to the house to get those rings is to zip across 95 between the two connectors, only about a mile. And I'm not familiar with the car, probably going a little too fast, passes a car, hits the soft shoulder, and rolls a convertible. Never a good scene. I'm not a far distance from there. The 911 call comes in. And what I don't realize is everyone's back at the church wondering where he is.
Mm.
And all of a sudden they hear a call that there's been an accident on 95 and they start in that direction. I arrive, he's deceased.
Mm.
I turn around and look back at my cruiser and his family are stacking up behind him and his mom and dad and everybody is starting to proceed toward his body. And I can remember I was kneeling over him and quickly trying to wipe dirt off the whites of his eyes.
Mm.
Because I didn't want his mom to see him like that.
Mm.
I'm 19.
Oh, man.
So I stand up and immediately hands out, saying, no, 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 you can't. Just don't. And I stop him at the back of my cruiser. And I remember holding his mom in my arms.
Mm.
And what do you say in that moment? You know, they have families arrive. They leave the scene. We put the body in the bag and the funeral director takes him away. And all those dreams, they're dashed. And now I'm back in the cruiser. I sign back on and ask, what do we have for calls? you know, and the next thing you know, I'm off at a barking dog complaint. And the Smiths are mad at the Johnsons because their dog won't stop barking. And they're asking themselves, why do I seem vacant? Why do I seem like that arrogant cop? But meanwhile, I still have the blood of that driver on my hands. I still have those thoughts rushing through my mind. That's every cop in this nation. I found myself in situations that I never thought I'd be in. I remember one night, late at night, getting a call that a dad was worried his son hadn't come home. And they called and they called and they started searching for him. Mom and dad out in the car looking for him. He'd gone to a party and he was unaccounted for. And the dad pulls in and the car is in the front lawn, kind of parked off on the side lawn. And phew, Junior's home. They go through the house, can't find him. They see the side door of the barn is wide open. He goes in, turns on the lights, looks up, and his son is hanging from a ligature across the beam. He had broken up with a girlfriend, wasn't thinking clearly, probably been drinking, and hung himself. We arrive.
You're the first one to see it.
First one there. Within an hour, I find myself going out on that beam with a knife to cut down the rope because I was the youngest guy there and probably the most nimble as two guys catch him. And again, you just go home. You compartmentalize that, and your family expects that you're going to show up ready for breakfast and be chipper. You know, your neighbors expect that you're going to still be the guy that can come over and help start their lawnmower. Everybody expects you to be happy old Jeff. And meanwhile, you still can see it, you can smell it, and it comes back to you often. And people expect, especially in crimes against victims. I've done a lot of, in my detective era of my career, I've done a lot of crimes against the sort of voiceless. I have done physical abuse against children, against sort of the mentally compromised. I've done cases with the elderly. It doesn't take a lot of that before you start to change your mindset on humanity. And it's very dangerous because once that seed is planted, most cops will deal with this hardening of the heart, which is the opposite of what originally called them to this work. And before long, they become sort of disfocused on why am I doing this for a lost and broken society? And they start to partner up.
Where life is so fragile.
So fragile, yeah. And so unprotected, where you have the wolf coming in and plucking out your sheep. And you feel, at times, it can feel like your work is fruitless. And you start to lose faith.
The image of the Sacred Heart is, it speaks to me so powerfully in those times where you're tempted to become frigid out of self-protection.
Yeah.
It's an image of agony. I mean, you have flames, you have thorns, you have blood. And it's just, you realize that both the joy, but also the constant pain that the Lord walked through life with. And just never became self-protective, never became frigid to the world and just said, here it is. It's a really hard thing to live out when you're, I mean, Jeff, especially for you and your line of work, I mean, you shared just two memories of tragedies where you're a first responder.
Sure.
You have stacks, you have files of those memories inside your head.
Yeah.
That could make, and one of those memories is enough to set someone's life in a different direction. You have stacks of those memories and then you're showing up at your kid's party. And like you see why so many cops have marital problems, because the expectation is like, well, why is dad distant and distracted? You know, you were sharing earlier about one time when you showed up to a McDonald's and share that.
Yeah, so as a detective for a sheriff's office in a very rural Maine, you know, I had 36 towns that I covered. We would be on scene for any death. That was the policy of the sheriff. A detective would be on scene to process, and some of them were natural deaths. And I found myself on scene with a death scene that was 5 to 6 weeks old, where the victim was well into decomposition. In processing that scene, I had another detective come in. We photographed it, processed it, packaged that guy up, got him on the road to the crime lab, collected evidence. All the time I'm looking at my watch because my oldest son, Samuel, has a 3-year-old birthday party within a half hour. I got to be there. You know, I've got the I've got the sheet cake in the back of my cruiser. This call came in at a bad time for me. So I'm getting everything done. I passed the scene off to one of the sergeants and said, I've got a boot, in a cop term. I've got to get out of here. I got to get to McDonald's for my son's birthday party. Yeah, you're good. You're good to go. So I zip and I pull into McDonald's and there's all the minivans lined up. There's all the little kids in the booths. They got the paper haps. Everybody's happy. I walk in. I pay for the Happy Meals. I'm doling them out. Chicken nuggets for you, cheeseburgers for you. I get a quarter pounder for myself and sit down with the adults, take the first bite, and I recognize I can smell decomposition all over my hands. You slide the burger away. Everybody still expects that you're going to be the jovial Jeff that they love, right? Mm-hmm. That you're going to celebrate. You're going to sing happy birthday and help blow out the candles. And meanwhile, there's this churning fire inside of you. And it's hard to quantify. Because of all these exposures where contentment and peace becomes almost impossible to find. There is a gift in being naive. But once it's lost, it's never regained. So you are thrust into a situation to deal with these nightmares one way or another. And they will not go away. The work itself, and to survive when you're young, you compartmentalize it. You put in shoe boxes and you slide it to the back of your mind. And you put, oh, that's another shoe box. I'm not gonna think about that. I'm gonna go wash my hands and we're gonna celebrate this birthday. Slide it to the back. The call outs during, you know, family events, you slide those to the back of your mind. But they're not gone. Yeah. They're coming back for you.
Yeah. What was the experience that you had that made you realize that they weren't gone? That all this stuff that was stacking up was infiltrating the present moment.
Yeah, I had a good friend of mine who was a psychologist, and he said, you know the problem with you, Jeff? You live your life like you're going to get all green lights. Like, meaning, I've got 7 minutes to get there. I'll leave with 6 minutes and 45 seconds, and I'm going to get there, right?
My wife's watching, she'd be like, yeah, that's you, Chris.
Yeah, you live like you're going to have all green lights. Yeah. And what that really means is I'm not dealing with these hardships as they come.
Yeah.
I don't recognize the chickens are going to come back to roost. And old guys will tell you this. The old cops would be like, yeah, take care of yourself. That stuff doesn't go away. I did that. Because in police work, you show up at very hard scenes, and you have to be that one steady stone in the middle of a ripping river. Somewhere people can cling to and swim to for stability. If you show up in that uniform and you're crying or you're pale in the face or you're pacing or you're swearing, you're just as bad as the people you're dealing with that circumstance. If you're not dressed right, dressed like we say, you just become part of the distraction. You're not the stability that situation needs.
So stuffing it is part of the job description.
It is. Being stone-faced and just dealing with it like you've been here 100 times. Now, that doesn't mean you don't get in your car and shed a tear later. That's what society expects of you.
Yeah.
That's what your tax money pays for. Well, I did that. I did that. I planned on all the green lights. I thought my life was going to be smooth. But the problem is with all these things is you have one budget. And all these things, you're cutting checks out of that budget constantly. And you're cutting them from work, and you're not redepositing. And eventually, you get more unexpected bills. And they can look like a divorce. They can look like the death of a father. They can look like a global pandemic with 7 children to raise. And before long, your account goes into the red. And you start questioning your own existence. You start asking yourself scary questions like, have I already lived my best days? Should I even be here any longer? And things like depression and anxiety sneak up from behind you. There's a commercial that runs on TV, it used to be, and its tagline is, depression hurts. And I thought to myself, what's that mean?
Yeah.
And I lived out, I recognized, depression hurts. You wake up with chest pain, and you wake up with a tight neck. You find yourself clenching and grinding your teeth.
Yeah.
You question, why did God create me?
So what was that point where you realized all this is going to come rushing forward. Like you can't just stuff it all the time forever.
Yeah, there was a watershed moment for me. Mm. I thought I was hitting those green lights. I've seen a few yellows. I knew I was stumbling. I knew I was 100%. I found myself in a Dunkin' Donuts on a Saturday morning because I couldn't sleep. I went there very early, bought a dozen donuts for my kids, and I was going to get a coffee. And when I was standing in line waiting to order, I was kind of observing everybody in the house, looking at the donuts. I knew I wasn't well. Mm. And I moved up, and the lady, sweet lady that took my order, I told her what I wanted, and I slid her a $20 bill. And when she slid it back to me, I looked at her hand, and she had this very specific red fingernail polish on each of her fingers. It was like Coca-Cola red. And she slid my change back. And I immediately felt my tears start to well up. It started to choke up. I got to a point where I felt hard to breathe. It was anxiety, stress in my chest. And I had data coming in, but I couldn't process what I was looking at and why this was the response to simply someone sliding change to me in red nail polish. I had tears running down my face. I grabbed the donuts, put the change in my pocket, grabbed my coffee, and got out of there. Put it in, you know, on my passenger seat and sat there and bawled.
Hmm.
I just cried like a child. And I allowed my mind to process. And like, where have I seen those red nails? Where have I seen those red nails? And it was somewhere around probably 2001, 2002, Easter morning, phone rang beside my bed. And this all rushed right back to my mind. I'd seen those nails. It was Easter morning. I got a call that a vehicle had overturned and they believed a passenger had been ejected and landed in a local river and they needed divers. I was a diver on our rescue dive team. I had been for years. Had done a lot of evidence recovery, a lot of dead body recoveries. Mm. So I raced there. It was about a half hour run, lights and siren, because nothing's close when you're in rural Maine. I pulled up, there's fire trucks on either side of our river bridge. Jumped out, popped my trunk, started pulling out my tank, my BC, my second stage, my lead belt, all the stuff I need, my fins. And I have the on-site command explaining to me the circumstance. We have an overturned vehicle. We have the driver, 22-year-old passenger, unaccounted for. We've already combed the field. We've looked up and down the sides of the road. We don't have her. You need to know her passenger side window is open or gone.
Mm.
We believe she may have been rejected into the river. All right. So as a diver, you have to rip off what you got for clothing, put on your wetsuit, get everything on. And in this light, the first rule of diving, anyone watches this is going to be like, oh, geez. First rule of diving is never dive alone.
Mm.
That doesn't actually cross over for this type of work. So I jump in, go over to the river's edge. A second diver shows up momentarily. And we look at where the ejection probably happened. Get in the river, find zero buoyancy, this place where you can just hover off the bottom and you let the current take you and see what you can see in the belly of that river.
Mm.
And before long, I came down and around, and there's a tree. And snagged in that tree is a young woman. Mm. And she's got auburn hair that's just flowing. Mm. Looks like it's in the wind. She's still wearing a dress that she had worn out the night before, and a coat, a jean jacket.
Mm.
And she's snagged, and her arms are proceeding forward. And on her hands are red fingernail polish. That point in time, second diver and I extract her from the tree up the riverbank. She's photographed, processed, and the scene is turned over to the on-premise investigators. And you take your wet gear off, shut the valves on your gear, your tanks, and put them back in, put everything away, slide whatever you wore there onto a wet body, and drive home because you've got to go get your kids into their Easter best. And you've got to set up the egg hunt, and you've got to go to your in-laws for dinner. And there's very little conversation about what you saw, and you're certainly not going to talk to your family about that on Easter morning. But again, that's one of those boxes slid to the back, and a cue just waiting to happen over red nail polish. And that woke up something in me that I recognized I was broken.
Mm.
And I needed to deal with it. I was not giving my children the best I could be. I was trying. I was fighting. But to be blunt and to be honest, I had actually slipped into a place where I myself was becoming suicidal. Mm. I didn't love life. I didn't love my own life. And I am a lover of life. I love the essence of everything this life can give me. Always loved adrenaline sports. I was big into mountain biking. I was always a skier. I loved just diving on my own. I played competitive sports. I've got 7 children that I love more than life. They're my reason for existence. And I wrestled daily to hold on to my own life because I was so broken. Mm. I found myself slipping into this mantra that was so bad for me, where I'd say over and over again, "Oh, I hate my life.
Mm.
I just hate my life."
Mm.
And I had a conversation with you about that. I remember asking you if that was sinful.
And I don't remember this, man.
It was a decade ago, and we went into it a bit. But I ended up speaking with my parish priest. And one of the things he said to me is, like, could you replace that with a simple prayer?
Yeah.
And at the time, I'd been praying, but my prayers were hollow. My prayers were like fights. I'd say to God, like, I am supposed to be your precious creation. Why would you let me go through this?
Mm.
And I was going through a lot, both professionally and personally. And my parish priest said, what if you just said, Jesus and Mary, you know my heart. Jesus and Mary, you know my heart.
Mm.
Meaning my flesh is falling short, but you know my heart.
What a great starting point. He wasn't even saying, go so far as to say, thank you for my life's great. Just go from the total darkness to, okay, I'm going to sit here with you, Lord.
It was an opportunity to not put on the airs of perfection. That I had it, I'm your responder.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the first responder. I come in and stop chaos for you. I was so broken, I needed someone to come in and stop it for me. And that started something. And I started to say that to myself on the regular, and I still do. Because when I stumble, and my flesh intends well, but I still stumble, I know my heart's intent.
Mm.
And to understand my Creator knows it as well.
Mm.
There's something beautiful in that.
Something that sets you apart from a lot of other people is that you were conscious of that false identity, that false perfectionism, that idealism of here's the image of a perfect cop.
Yeah.
And conscious that giving into that is going to lead to your demise.
Yeah.
You got to break through to the other side.
Yeah.
Countless people literally die because they don't break through that.
Mm.
I was reading this from the NIH website that almost 20% of cops in urban settings, quote, report experiencing adverse consequences of alcohol use. So they got a problem. So that's a high percentage of people. That's like astronomically higher than the regular population. Almost 10%, quote, met the criteria for alcohol abuse or dependence. 1 out of 10.
Yeah.
There's probably not been studies done for priests, but it's pretty dang high with priests too.
Yeah.
Because they're good dudes. They know who they have to be in front of everybody. They're internalizing all this stress, all this trauma that the rest of humanity doesn't have to see because of you guys, frankly.
Right.
So thank you for that, right? But just piling it up. But this isn't just cops. I mean, this speaks to everybody.
Yeah,
it speaks to the mom who's pregnant with her 5th kid and overwhelmed with the first 4, and has all these beautiful ideals. They're good ideals. All the ideals you said about being a cop are good. About being a Catholic mom, but wants to call somebody and say, yes, this is a blessing, but I feel like I'm drowning and someone just threw me a boulder to help me with my drowning. You know, I feel like I'm losing my mind. When people don't talk because of the self that they're putting forward to the world, I mean, that leads to the isolation where the devil could just start destroying us.
Right.
I did a show with my best friend at the time killed himself. He died by suicide years ago. He was the director of family life for the Diocese of La Crosse, Wisconsin. You know, wasn't a cop, but gosh, you're in ministry. You have a self that you're putting forward.
Right.
And when you feel like I'm demolished, that false self is going to just keep your mouth shut. Mm-hmm. The evil one could just put you in a corner and just beat you to death.
Yeah.
How do you break through? How did you get over that? And I'm asking on behalf of not just the law enforcement person, the person who's suicidal, who got out of the military, but the mom who's losing it,
yeah,
the priest, the whoever it is, and feels like, I can't do that because I'm this perfect person.
Yeah.
How do you get over it?
Well, for starters, I would want to say, of course, my perspective is going to be law enforcement.
Yeah, but it's going to apply to everybody, man.
But
really
I'm
does.
Dad first,
yeah.
Right? So those parents out there that are doing the good work of being a parent, first I would say, thank you. Thank you for stepping up in those early days and knowing there's going to be a cost, but recognizing it was worth it.
Mm.
I often, when I see somebody else, retiring out, I'll put in a card. Thank you for your sacrifice.
Hmm.
Not thank you for your time, not thank you for your service. Thank you for your sacrifice because it's personal and this costs you. Now, I talked about a budget before, right? It costs you a big check out of your budget.
Yeah.
And I think sadly in society, and thanks to things like social media where we can look in on people's lives so much easier, we have to have it all together. And in police work, yeah. Your uniform better be starched, your gig line better be on, your badge better be square, you better not have any dandruff on your shoulders. And again, you are the one running toward the fire. You are the one standing in the middle of absolute chaos and not breaking a sweat.
I mean, but you're right, social media. There's now eighth grade kids bearing the stress of managing their online brand.
It's unbelievable. And so when
and it's not okay being a human anymore.
When you set yourself up to hit all the green lights,
yeah.
When you set yourself up to live in a glass house where people look at you and be like, oh, that's Wrigley. He's great in these circumstances. He'll hold it all together. Let's call him.
Mm.
When you start to recognize that your foundation's starting to crack, when you start to whisper to yourself, I hate this life. I wish I'd just die. But you don't verbalize that to everyone else. It becomes extremely dangerous. You are captive, and your captor is whispering these things to you on repeat.
Mm.
And many of them are not rational, they make no sense, and the outcomes are never what they tell you they are. That's anxiety. Worst possible outcomes, quite often from circumstances that they're never gonna get there anyways. But in the arena of your mind, unverbalized, they will ravage you. So what do I say? Cops do it right on step one. They tend to look to another cop to talk to.
Hmm.
It's tribalism. They look to someone else that will hear them and affirm them, but quite often it's not healthy because it's talking about things like against the man or against society as they crack another beer together.
Hmm.
What is better is that you seek the good counsel of someone you trust. I went to a therapist myself.
Good for you, man. Yeah.
A very good friend of mine approached me. I love this man, I've known him for a long time. I was drill staff at the police academy, an honor that I will clutch to for the rest of my life. I loved it. I lived at the academy, I had 58 children I cared for. I quite often say being drill staff at the academy was the best experience I had to prepare me to have seven children.
Wow.
One of those cadets ended up working for a local agency, and he and I got closer and closer to eventually we worked for the same agency by chance. And he called me one day and said, hey, we got to talk. Where are you? I said, I don't have time. I got to get home to my family. He said, well, I'm going to tell you now. He said, you're not right. He's like, you're not yourself.
Well,
you're not well. And he's like, you need to hear this. You're valuable.
Mm.
I love you.
Mm.
Your family loves you. And you are needed.
Mm.
And he said, in my own life, I wouldn't be where I am if it wasn't for you. I have to have you here, Jeff.
Mm.
He could see where my path was headed, and it wasn't a good one. The last thing he said to me is, find someone. Go find someone to talk to. Thank God I found a good therapist. I found a psychologist who was a former firefighter. And I sat down with him, and I wept.
Wow.
And I wept, and I wept. And he said to me, which of your sons is most like you personality-wise? And I told him. And he said, how many days would you allow him to to feel the way you feel and to carry the burden you carry. And I lost my breath crying. I said, I wouldn't let him do it a day. Wow. So then why are you not seeking help? We went through a number of things that were triggering me, a number of things that were whispering to me on the regular. And as I left, he said, I'm going to see you in 2 days. What is it you need to get through these 2 days? I said, I need the antidote for anxiety.
Well.
He said, well, the whole world does. He said, but as well as I know, this is what I would say. Those things that are going on in your head, take them out. Verbalize them to somebody. As soon as they start to talking to you, call your sister. Mm-hmm. Call that person you trust and say, I can't stop thinking about this. Worst possible outcome. And allow that person to explain to you why it's not reality. It's the devil's voice looking to take you down. I did that, and it worked. And praise it continued God. To work. The next thing I would say is return to day one. Return to the joy that brought you to this vocation.
Whatever it is.
Whatever it is.
Yeah.
There is a reason why you chose it. For me, I've shown you a photo of my graduation day with my mom staring up at me.
Beautiful.
My mom's 5'6", I'm 6'4", and she's looking at me with this joy. I love that photo, and it's not about me, because I've done my family well.
Mm.
They're proud. When I returned to that day, it was so full of joy. I had the full toolkit of what it was going to take to save the world, I thought. But I left my work every day feeling so fulfilled that I had made a change in someone's life. I had made things better for someone.
Mm.
And at the end of my career, all I was doing was thinking about myself. I say the end of my career, I'm not at the end of my career. But before I sought help, all I played on repeat was all the ways I was falling short, all the ways I was a failure, and all the ways I was insignificant to this world.
Wow.
And by investing in myself, returning to those joys, trying out something new for me called self-care.
Imagine that.
Imagine that. The 20-year-old Jeff would go on a mountain bike ride after he went to the gym and get himself something good to eat.
Yeah.
Instead, I was doing my children's laundry.
Yeah.
Sweeping out the kitchen, getting everyone to bed, and having a bowl of Cheerios because that was what was left.
Hmm.
And then getting up at 06:30 and doing it again just because it was what I was expected to do.
And the kids need a clean floor. It's like, no, the kids need a happy, sane dad. That's what the kids need.
Absolutely.
The kids need a happy, sane mom. That's what the kids need. You know, put your own oxygen mask on before assisting other passengers. I mean, people feel selfish when they do that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And you're leaving them with the most burnt out version of you when you don't. And that's not selfless.
No, it's not. And the dangerous thing with things like alcohol or drugs or even affairs or running from your past is your past is still there waiting for you.
Yeah.
And those things just tend to take the microphone away from your taunter.
Yeah.
And you're not dealing with the issue.
A great beauty of what your friend said to you, that as I say the words, that you leave people with the most burned out version of you, I do a gut check. Like, Chris, do you really believe the greatest blessing you are to your family isn't all the stuff you're doing for them?
Oh, my word, yeah.
It's just who you are. Like, that fundamental belief is what leads to the kind of self-care that says, I'm going to get help. I'm going to talk to a counselor. I'm going to go on that bike ride. I'm going to take a deep breath as I look at the sunset. Because the kind of person I am is the blessing.
Yeah.
It is the blessing on a camera, to my staff, to my family. But that takes that self-love that, again, all these lies of the evil one. No, it's all in what you produce. It's all in what you do. It's all in the image that you put out. And it's killing us, man.
I'm telling you, I think one of the most beautiful parts of taking care of yourself is watching the lights come back on.
Hmm.
Joy returns. Flavor returns.
Literally. Okay, I taste that food. It's great.
Music's beauty. I find myself driving for hours in a silent car, going through my list of shortcomings. Before long, beauty returns to your life in all the ways. You see the little sort of events in your life, your children's beauty, their little characteristics, the things they say all of a sudden that take great value. And before long, all the lies of the devil that you are broken and your best days have passed just slip away because you recognize that beauty is here and is present. And your greatest day is the fulfillment of your promise that's yet to come. It's living out these days with the beautiful people, the beautiful experiences, all the wonder that surrounds you, that when you were stuck in this rut and your captor was beating you with all the darkness you couldn't see, all of that can return. And you can get back in the fight. See, this is the wonderful thing about hardship. We don't get strong unless we tear muscle. We don't get wise unless we go through tribulations. We don't get respect unless we've been through the fight and stand strong. So this is a grand opportunity. It's like the dark night of the soul, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
oh, yeah.
To have one light left on inside that barely moves you ahead and to throw them all back on and now to have the fullness and the understanding that through this trial, I can give Christ glory because he never left.
Amen. Praise God. Jeff, thank you for your sacrifice.
Yeah, thank you.
And in that thank you, I also mean everybody in law enforcement, everybody who's suffered on the front lines of a battlefield or as a paramedic. Thanks for all the horrible memories that you bear so that everybody else can live a normal life and be spared those same frontline experiences.
Yeah.
But thanks more for fighting the battle for yourself because that was worth fighting so that you could be sitting here right now as my friend and as a blessing and encouragement to other people.
Yeah, man. Thank you.
Thank you, brother. Love you, man.